We know that one of the prohibitions that in effect on Tisha B'Av is the prohibition against studying Torah, because the Pasuk describes learning Torah as something that brings a person happiness. And therefore one is not permitted to study Torah on Tisha B'Av. However, there are some exceptions, because there are certain passages in Tanakh and in the Gemara which are considered very suitable for Tisha B'Av. It's appropriate to study those things because those passages contribute to the feeling that's supposed to prevail during the course of the day. And one of the passages is the section of the Gemara in Masechet Gittin, the fifth parak, beginning on Daf Nun Hayamid Beis, where the Gemara has various stories relating to the Churban destruction, particularly the second Beis HaMikdash. And it's permissible to study those passages in the Gemara even on Tisha B'Av. And of course, one of the famous stories that most of us learned in one way or another is the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. The Gemara in Gittin Daf Nun Hayamid Beis says, "Kamsa Bar Kamsa Charb Yerushalayim." One of the reasons why the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, from the second Beis HaMikdash, is the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. To review very quickly, there was a certain fellow who was not identified by name in the Gemara. There are seats both sides. There's a certain gentleman who was not identified by name, who was a very wealthy man. He was apparently making a big party, and he had a friend by the name of Kamsa that he wanted to invite to his banquet, and he had another fellow in town by the name of Bar Kamsa. Some actually say it was a father and son. That's another discussion. But whoever it was, this Bar Kamsa was not to be invited to the party, and somehow, as fate would have it, the messenger who was supposed to deliver the invitations got mixed up, and the guy who wasn't really invited to the party ended up showing up, and the person who was hosting the party was so infuriated when he saw this guy here, he says, "Get out of my home." And the other fellow was terribly embarrassed, but he said, "Listen, don't embarrass me in public like this. I'll sit in the corner, I'll eat, I'll pay for whatever I eat, and I won't lose any money." And the guy refused, and he says, I'll pay for 10 people, I'll pay for the whole party." He negotiated back and forth, and under no circumstances would the host of this party allow this other fellow to stay, and he had to leave, having been humiliated in public like that. And the Gemara then makes a very indicting remark on Daf Nun Vav and Aleph and Gittin. The Gemara says, "Hoel v'haviyasi rabbanon v'lo michu bo v'lo mochu bei shmami no konichalahu." The Gemara says that the rabbanon, there were great Torah scholars who were present at that banquet, and none of them said a word. None of them went up to the host and said, "Listen, enough, let the guy stay, we'll work it out." Nobody intervened, everybody sort of turned a blind eye to this, and this person was publicly humiliated. The Gemara goes on to say what disaster happened because of that. But what we see is that sometimes we are our own worst enemies, and we engage in behavior that maybe makes sense at the moment, but can be very, very destructive. And I believe that it's worthwhile on Tisha B'Av, even as we mourn destruction, there are still seeking. Even if we mourn the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash at the hands of enemies, at the hands of the Babylonians and the Romans and everybody else, but to some extent there are a lot of seats available on the site. There are situations which arose not only then, but continue to arise even in our own time, where we are, as I say, our own worst enemies, and sadly, even great Rabbanim, great Talmid Chachamim, have not been exempt from falling into this situation where their behavior is less than exemplary. And the topic I want to focus on for the talk is the rabbinic controversy, or rabbinic scandal that shook 18th century Jewry. I refer to the quarrel between the Yonason Eibershitz and the Yankov Emden, about whom we'll speak shortly. Much of the material I'm going to present is based on the research and the writings and classes of Rabbi Dr. Schneur Lyman. I've quoted in the past. Rabbi Lyman has been professor at virtually every major university, or visiting professor at virtually every major university in the United States and in Israel. A great expert on, I think Rabbi Wein once called him an expert on all things Jewish. And I don't think it's an exaggeration. He is, he's Asher Musmach of the Mir Yeshiva, but he has a doctorate from the University of Pennsylvania. Really a unique individual. I've had the privilege to hear some of his classes. One of my sons took a course in YU last year that he gave on this subject, on the Renison Edership and the Academic Controversy. I mention that because to explore the subject properly, it takes a whole course. This is a whole semester course, and we're not going to be here for a whole semester. I was trying to give you an overview of what went on and the negative effect that it had and what we could perhaps ponder on Tisha B'Av. But before actually going into the event itself, we need a little bit of background as to what was going on in the world at that time. And for that, we go back a century to the 17th century, the 1600s, and we actually we had one of the Tisha B'Av classes many years ago. I focused upon this topic, and that is the events in the life of the messianic pretender Shabtai Tzvi. Now, the mid-1600s, there was a terrible, terrible series of pogroms in Europe in the year 1648 and 1649, led by an individual named Khmelnytsky. We spoke about that one year also over the years. I don't know if this is 20 years or more. We've had this class on Tisha B'Av afternoon, so we covered a lot of these. Unfortunately, there's no shortage of these events. But we covered the Khmelnytsky massacres, referred to in Jewish and rabbinic literature very often as Gzeros Tach V'Tat. Tav Ches and Tav Tes, that was the Hebrew year. Tav Ches was 1648. You got Tav Shin Ches was 1948. The Israel was established 1948, so knock out the Shin, 300 years earlier, 1648. Tav Ches and Tav Tes, Tach the Tat. That was a period of disaster for the Jewish people in Europe. In the aftermath of that, the depression and the anxiety over Golus was such that the people really expected the arrival of the Mashiach at any moment and longed for it, and it was in this backdrop, against the backdrop, that Shabtai Tzvi arrived on the scene. Now, he was born in the year 1626, actually on Tisha B'Av, although it's possible that that was doctored later on, because we have a tradition that the Messiah, the Mashiach, would be born on Tisha B'Av. So whether he was actually born on Tisha B'Av, I'm not sure how accurate all the records happen to be, but it's listed, it's announced, it's presented that he was born on Tisha B'Av in 1626, in Izmir, or Smyrna in Turkey. He was a person who suffered from melancholy, and I'm not going into his whole life now, we spoke about him a few years ago. But in the year 1665, he went to Eretz Yisrael and met up with a fellow there by the name of Nathan of Gaza. Always had trouble in Gaza, well, here was one of them. Nathan of Gaza was a self-proclaimed prophet, sort of like a healer. He used Kabbalistic formulae and incantations to cure people of various illnesses, and the Shabtai Tzvi went to him initially and hoping that this Nathan of Gaza will assist him. He had visions and he had strange thoughts and so on, including some messianic thoughts, and he went to the Nathan of Gaza, I think initially to hope to be healed by him. Again, they used Kabbalah and different things. Anyway, one thing led to another, and the 17th of Sivan, 1665, corresponding to May 31st, 1665, Shabtai Tzvi proclaimed himself, became convinced that he was in fact the Mashiach, and he announced himself as such, and Nathan of Gaza was his prophet. So you have now an individual in 1665 who would announce that he was Mashiach. Without going into all the details now, it caught on. Many people opposed him, many people thought he was just plain crazy, but many people, including Rabbanim, including Talmud Chachamim, initially in Eretz Yisrael and beyond, believed that he was the Mashiach, that the Messianic era was in fact at hand. Jews were eager to believe it, especially having recently undergone such a dark period in Europe especially, and word spread, and he did certain things, or at least there were reports that he did certain things that would confirm that he was the Messiah, and so on and so forth, and it really caught on. I'm going to read you, again we'll get to the main topic shortly, but it's important to have this background information just in order to understand the backdrop. I'm going to read you from a very fascinating book called The Memoirs of Glucal of Haman. Glucal of Haman was a Jewish woman who, at the age of 44, began in the year 1690 to write, in effect, a memoir, autobiography, sort of, which was unusual in general. It was unusual, certainly, for a woman, but it's a very valuable piece of historical work because it gives insight. This woman is telling about her life, and she was from a rich family and so on, but and it gave tremendous first-hand insight into Jewish life at that time. You know, she certainly did not imagine, I suppose, that this book would become really one of the few first-hand accounts of what Jewish life was like. Very fascinating to read. I mean, where Jews could live and how Jews were expelled from here and the fears of plague and all kinds of things. This was from a woman of privilege. she kind of wrote it after her husband's death as a cathartic experience, it would seem. So, you know, to sort of come to grips with that and so on, the difficulty. I mean, she was born in Hamburg in 1646, right before the years of Tachlathat. So she was a baby at that time. She was born in Hamburg. Jews were expelled from Hamburg, and she moved to a nearby place called Altona. Remember the name? That's important in our controversy. Well, just a coincidence, but she moved to Altona, even though, you know, that's in the north of Germany. Hamburg, the north of Germany. That Altona was under the control of the King of Denmark, whom she praises, generally speaking. But anyway, Jews couldn't live in Hamburg for a while, and she writes about her experiences. So I'm going to read you now from the memoirs of Glucke of Hamon, talking about, again, you know, her life. And she writes, at about this time, she was betrothed, she was engaged at the age of 12, she got married at the age of 14, and she went into the business with the family and so on. Anyway, at about this time, people began to talk of Shabtai Tzvi, the messianic pretender. But woe unto us that we have sinned. Oino lano chichatan, it's a pasuk. It's interesting, this is a from woman, obviously, the work, this is an English translation, but, you know, the work is peppered with, you know, quotes from Chazal and from Tanakh and so on. That was the way people, from people spoke at that time. Anyway, so she quotes the pasuk, Oino lano chichatan, woe unto us that we have sinned and never lived to see what we had heard and believed. When I think of the repentance done by young and old, my pen fails me. The whole world knows of it. O Lord of all worlds, Ribono Olam, I'm hoping as we did that you had shown compassion on Israel and redeemed us. We were like a woman who sits in labor and suffers mighty pangs. We just said Elit Zion at the end of the Tisha B'Av Kinas, Kimo Isha of the Tzireha, right? So she says, we were like a woman who sits in labor and suffers mighty pangs and thinks that once her suffering is over, she shall be blessed with a child. Right? Elit Zion ends the Kinas because we say, we wail and we complain, but we say, Kimo Isha of the Tzireha, the woman is having the pangs of childbirth. At least at the end, if all goes well, she has Baruch Hashem a child, so all the pain is difficult. At least there's a positive result. That's why we end the kinnis with that. So she said, that's what we, you know, we've suffered, but we had hoped it was going to come to a positive end. And the Messianic era was at hand, but it was only hearkening after wind. And so, dear God and King, it befell unto us. Throughout the world, your servants and children rent themselves with repentance, prayer, and charity, tshuva, tzil, and tzedakah. For 2 or even 3 years, your beloved people Israel sat in labor, but there came forth nothing but wind. It was not enough we were unworthy to behold the child for whom we had labored and in whom our hope was sure. We were left in the end abandoned. You know, when it turns out that he wasn't the Mashiach, you know, you can imagine what the result was. Our joy, still, my Lord and God, your people Israel despair not. We daily trust that in your mercy you will redeem them. The redemption be deferred, yet every day I hope it's coming. That's the Animamin, of course. When it will be your will, you'll remember your people Israel. Our joy when the letters arrived from Smyrna in Turkey is not to be told. Most of them were addressed to the Sfardim, who lived in the community, who as fast as they came took them to their synagogue and read them aloud, young and old. The Germans, too, hastened to the Sephardic synagogue. Imagine the scene, you know. The Sephardic youth came dressed in their best finery and decked in broad green silk ribbons, the gear of Shabtai Tzvi, with timbrels and with dancers, the Sufim and Mecholos. They one and all trooped to the synagogue, and they read the letters forth with joy like the joy of the Simchas Beis HaShoeva. Now listen to this. Many sold their houses and land and all their possessions, for any day they hoped to be redeemed. My good father-in-law, she writes, left his home in Hamun, abandoned his house and lands and all his goodly furniture, and moved to Hildesheim. He then sent on to us in Hamburg 2 enormous casks, packed with linen and with peas, beans, dried meat, shredded prunes, and like stuff, every manner of food that would keep. For the old man expected to sail any moment from Hamburg to the Holy Land. More than a year the casks lay in my house. At length, the old folks feared the meat and other edibles would rot, and they wrote us we should open the cask and remove the foodstuff to save the linens from ruin. For 3 years, the cask stood ready, and all the while, my father-in-law awaited the signal to depart. But the Most High willed otherwise. And full well, we know I'm certain God will have mercy on us, and so on and so forth. And then she goes back to her story. I mean, people sold their homes and sold their land and prepared and packed and got everything together because they were just waiting. Any day now is going to come an announcement that we have to all pick up and head for Eretz Yisrael. The Mashiach has arrived. And here you have the first-hand account of someone who was alive at the time describing how her own father-in-law prepared everything and had everything in the house packed and ready to go. Again, the old man expected to set sail at any moment from Hamburg to the Holy Land. Well, in 1666, on September 15th of that year, Shabtai Tzvi converted to Islam. However, the movement did not stop. The movement did not die. Nathan of Gaza, his prophet, and other of his followers had terutzim, had explanations. But this is not, it does not mean that he wasn't not really the Mashiach. No, this is a detour. It's mysterious, it's hard for us to understand, but up in Kabbalah and Kabbalistic literature, there's something called the klipa of certain impurities that have to be removed, and so the way he's doing it, he converts to Islam and is able to, whatever, add explanations for it, to rescue the klipas. In 1676, 10 years later, at the age of 50 years old, on Yom Kippur of that year, Shabtai Tzvi died. But again, the movement did not die with him. Nathan of Gaza said he didn't die, but rather he was transformed. And we've heard that recently in some circles too. Right? But that was the explanation. He didn't die. He became part of the Godhead. He joined the Kabbalistic spheres. Right? And the movement continued. Now in 1680, this Nathan of Gaza himself died 4 years after Shabtai Tzvi died, but he had successors who worked out. They had terutzim. They had explanations. They're going to include Rabbanim to explain everything that happened is all part of the messianic process. Of course, as the situation dragged on in that direction, less and less people remained convinced after a while. But still, the movement did not really die. The Jews at that time, especially those who had followed him, had to grapple with certain important questions. Would there be a second coming of the Mashiach? Is he going to come back? Again, we've heard these questions debated in the last 20 years around here also. Will there be a second coming? Should all Jews convert to Islam? Because he did, in fact, in Salonika in the year 1683, 7 years after Shabtai Tzvi had died, and 17 years after he converted, some 300 families in Salonika in Greece converted to Islam because that's what he did, so we're presumably supposed to follow his direction. And what about observance of halacha? The followers of Shabtai Tzvi, convinced that he was the Mashiach, abandoned all observance of Tainus Tzibur, of fast days, including Tisha B'Av. The Pasuk says that, you know, in the future, these days will be made Simcha, days of gladness. The Pasuk in Zechariah says that with in the future time, the Tzom HaRaviyah, the Tzom HaMishi, Tzom HaShvi'i, and Tzom HaAsiri, all the four fast days in association with the Churban, Yehi Beis Yehuda, L'Sasim, L'Simcha, and so on. So they already began to observe it that way. Now what happens? What do we do now? And so, as a result of all of this, there were different groups of Jews who continued long after Shabtai Tzvi had converted, long after he died, to continue. They continued to maintain that he was the Mashiach, he's going to come back, or someone else is going to come back, and it's all part of the process. And there were different groups. These Jews are now, from a historical point, were known as Sabbateans, followers of Shabtai Tzvi, Sabbateans. There were different groups of Sabbateans. There was a moderate group, which included Rabban and other distinguished people, especially in Turkey, Italy, and Poland. They were Shomrei Torah Mitzvahs. They were indistinguishable in appearance and in hanhag and in conduct from any other Jews. They had beards and payas and dressed the same as everybody else. The women, everybody, they were all the same. They were indistinguishable on the outside from any other Jew, and they kept mitzvahs and they kept Shabbos and Yontov and Kasher and Taras and Shoch and everything else. However, they secretly believed or privately maintained that indeed Shabtai Tzvi was the Messiah. He was the Mashiach, and he would return soon. They didn't make a fuss about that belief. They didn't publicize. They kept it to themselves, and they were, again, outwardly just like everybody else. They said Tehillim. You know, perhaps some of them were maybe ascetics, or they said Tikkun Chatzos, you know. But again, looked and behaved like everybody else. There were others who also were Jews who dressed like everybody else, but they led kind of a, sort of like a double life. And they said that just as Shabtai Tzvi dressed up as a Muslim when he converted, but he didn't really convert, he maintained his Judaism, so too we address the Jews, behave as Jews, but secretly did not keep Torah Mitzvahs. Now the first group kept Torah Mitzvahs. And they kept the kashrus and Shabbos and Taras and Shochan. But the only thing is that they believed that Tzavtetzi was Mashiach. The second group outwardly conduct themselves as Jews, but privately did not observe Torah and mitzvahs anymore. They did not do mitzvahs. In fact, there was a bracha, you know, we have a bracha, the bracha say in the morning is Matir Asurim. Kadosh Baruch Hu frees those who are Asur, who are bound up or tied up. They changed the bracha to read Matir Isurim. Kadosh Baruch Hu has been Matir Isurim, prohibitions. And they thought that it was mutter, at least privately do things. We have testimony, and in one of the Lyman's articles, he quotes this, of women who appeared before Batei Din, admitting that they had had extramarital relations with this one. The names are mentioned, is that we have rabbinic records in Germany from Batei Din, that they admitted having, being mezana, having an adulterous relation with men, but with their husband's permission, with the husband's encouragement. This was mutter, this was allowed, it's the messianic era, rules don't apply, all the same rules don't apply, and so on. There are records of this. And so, and by the way, these records are from the mid-18th century. So we're talking about some 100 years, almost 100 years, after Shabtai Tzvi had already converted to Islam. He still had people who believed this. So that was another group. Then there were others who, a group called the Don Meh, D-O-E-N-M-E-A-H, the way they spelled in Encyclopedia Judaica, if you want to look it up. These were Jews, particularly in Salonika, who outwardly were Muslims and dressed as Muslims, acted as Muslims, but secretly kept Judaism, at least to the extent that they felt that Shabtai Tzvi had done so. Just as a point of reference, at the time of World War I, in 1914, there were still 10 to 15,000 of these Don Meir people alive. And in fact, there is still a small group in the United States today that meets on a fairly regular basis in Washington, D.C. So there still is this group of people who were influenced by Shabtai Tzvi still around today. The fourth group, the group known as the Frankists, there was another messianic pretender, Jacob Frank, who claimed to be, or some claimed that he was, the reincarnation of Shabtai Tzvi. That was a group called the Frankists. They eventually converted to Christianity. They did not keep any halacha and so on. So you had these different groups. Now, and again, this is still part of the background. I know the background's long, but it's important to understand. Okay? That was almost as long as the presentation, but it's very important to have it clear. In the 18th century, for the most part, in most communities, those who were Sabbateans kept it to themselves. The movement kind of was underground. Okay, there were people around, like I mentioned, was no question. And many of them, as I say, were indistinguishable in appearance, and many of them even indistinguishable in conduct from other Jews. The 18th century was an oasis, to some extent, in terms of Jewish history, because it was a century where there were no major persecutions and no major pogroms that we know of. Again, there were things always, were things in different towns and shtetls and so on. But as a rule, there was nothing rivaling the Crusade or the Khmelnytsky or other things like that. Did not have any major persecution of Jews. It was also just before modernity as had set in, so you did not yet have the assimilation that would follow with the Haskalah and other things. It was a relatively tranquil century. It was also a remarkable century in terms of the thinkers and great intellectuals in the non-Jewish world. So this was the century of Immanuel Kant, of Voltaire, and here in the colonies in America was Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin. But among Jews, if you consider who the Rabbanim were in the 1700s, in the 18th century at that time, it reads like an all-star team of people all of us have heard of and still study today. Just to give you an idea of who was living at this time. In the Hasidic world, you had the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidim, and his Talmidim, including the Maggid of Meserich, of Dov Ber of Meserich, and the Baal HaTanya, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, the founder of Chabad Hasidus, of Shneur Zalman of Liadi. Among the quote-unquote Misnagdim, or those who didn't weigh in either way, of course, the Vilna Gaon is alive at this time. The Noda Yehuda, the chief rabbi of Prague, of the Cheskel Landau. The Pnei Yoshua was a little older, but the Pnei Yoshua, these again, you go to yeshivas, these are the works that are studied, okay? The Pnei Yoshua was really the older, the Gadol, considered the Gadol Ador. The Aflor, also the Machman Kiddush and Aflor, particularly the Levi Horowitz. The Shagas Aryeh was living in Metz at that time. Again, people who know learning and know rabbinic literature, it's an astounding list of people. Ramosha Chaim Lutzato, Ramchal, was living at that time in Padua. The Chidor, the great Sephardi authority. Chaim Yosef David Azulai, the Chidor was in Livorno in Eretz Yisrael. Moses Mendelssohn was alive at that time, started a different movement. So you just get an idea of the incredible array of Talmidei Chachamim and scholars that this is unbelievable, that flourished during that century. In fact, there's a statement attributed to the Chassam Sofer, who said that from the time of the Dor HaMidbar, the generation that received the Torah, until the 18th century, there was no Dor like this. And that's a loaded statement, because that includes the period of the Tanoim, the period of Amoraim, the period of Rishonim. I mean, that's quite a statement. Now, again, I didn't find this in any writings of Sam Sofer, but I found it in print from someone who, Talmud of the Sam Sofer, says that's what he said. That from the time of the Dor HaMidbar until the 18th century, you never had a Dor with as many prominent people as this Dor. Now, even if you take that to be somewhat of an exaggeration, you get the picture of what was going on. And two of the great Talmidei Chachamim at that time were our heroes for today's presentation, Rabbi Yonasan Eberschitz and Rabbi Yaakov Emden. The Sam Sofer said, had it not been for that machlokas between Rabbi Yonasan Eberschitz and Rabbi Yaakov Emden, it would certainly have been worthy for the Mashiach to actually come in that generation. So let's talk a little bit about these two individuals. Rabbi Yonasan Eberschitz was born in Poland in 1690. His great grandfather was the Megala Amukos, important Rav. His father was a Rav in a town called Eberschitz. Many times people got their last names from the town that they came from in those days. And he was a child prodigy. He was an Eloy, from the time of a little kid. It was clear that he was destined for greatness in Torah scholarship. He married in 1710. In 1713, he went to Hamburg. And in 1714, you know, at the ripe old age of 24, he became the Darshan in Prague and eventually the Rosh Bezdin in Prague at a very young age. He was a Talmudic genius. And in 1742, he succeeded the Pnei Yehoshua as the Rav in Metz, again, one of another major Jewish center, and he became, in his time, the Rosh Yeshiva. Rabbi Eberschitz was the Rosh Yeshiva in Europe in the 1700s. Even in non-Orthodox historical accounts, he had thousands and thousands of talmidim. They say until Rav Soloveitchik, who signed all the smichas in YU, Rav Yonasan Eberschitz had given more smichas to more people than to anybody else. He was the Rosh Yeshiva. People flocked from all over Europe to come to his yeshiva, to associate with him. He wrote, according to some records, some 200 svarim, including certain classics. Again, the sefer called Urim Tumim and Choshen Mishpat is a classic. For those of you, no one learns Choshen Mishpat without reading the Tumim, the crazy place in Yeridea. We have other svarim from Rav Yonasan Eberschitz, more than published recently. Just simply, one of the greats. No other way to put it. One of the greats, in many centuries. A tremendous mind. In 1750, he moved to Altona. That's the city I mentioned before where Gluck of Hamon lived at one stage. So he moved to Altona, and he lived there till the end of his life, and dying in 1764. That's the Yonasan Eberschitz. Rabbi Yaakov Emden was born in Altona. Okay, again, it's part of Hamburg. You see three cities together. Sometimes in rabbinic literature, you see the cities Aleph, Hey, Vav. It's Altona, Hamburg, and Wandsbek, which were sort of like cities right close to each other. Anyway, so Rabbi Yaakov Emden was born in Altona in 1697, so he was 7 years younger than Rabbi Yonasan Eberschitz. He was the oldest son of the Chacham Tzvi. Again, another well-known posuk of Tzvi Ashkenazi. We have Chuvus and the Chacham Tzvi. So the Chacham Tzvi was the father of Yaakov Emden. That's why sometimes you see Yaakov Emden is identified. There are other people that have similar identification, but sometimes he's called Yavetz. The other people Yavetz, not all. But his Yavetz stands for Yaakov Emden Ben Tzvi. Right, his chuvas, he has a collection of his sponsor chuvas called Charles of Chuvas Shilas Yavetz. So Yaakov Emden was born in 1697. He's the eldest son of the Chacham Tzvi. His father, the Chacham Tzvi, and his grandfather, Shaar Ephraim, I think, had been the Rav of chief rabbis in Altona. But Yaakov Emden was not, and never would be, the chief rabbi of Altona. Hamburg, I think it's three cities, Altona, Hamburg, and Wandsbek. He had been for 3 years a Rav in a small town, a port city called Emden, from 1728 to 1731. To say the least, he was not cut out for Rabbas. He was a bit of a loner, you might even call him a misanthrope. He did not like dealing with people, did not like interacting with people, and he was not at all cut out for Rabbanus. He went into private business. and simply lived as a balabos. He got married in 1715 to a woman that his father selected, the Chacham Tzvi selected, and in his autobiography later, he described he never liked her to begin with. That's the way he talked, that's the way he was. He only married her, he really wanted to marry someone else, but his father arranged this shit, and that's who he married, and so on. He was a bitter person in many ways. He moved back to Alton in 1733 and lived there till he died in 1776. Also wrote many sorum. There's a classic parish on the Siddur called Siddur Beis Yaakov in Emden, which is a work on some of the diktuk of the Siddur, a really classic from the Siddur. It's available. I have it at home. A Siddur Beis Yaakov. You have tshuvas from him and various other works. One of the reasons he's able to write a lot of works is that he happened to have a printing press in his house. Which, again, can be dangerous if you're an explosive personality and are bent to quickly writing things down. We know that today, you send out an email and you feel bad a half hour later you sent it, right? Well, in those days, you couldn't quite send an email, but he had a printing press. He could print things on his own. We'll see in a moment that becomes important. Sam Sofer said that Yaakov Emden's parish on the Siddur is the best parish on the Siddur there is. But he had a difficult life. He married three times. The first two wives died. He buried 11 children in his lifetime. Okay, and in the old age he became blind. He had a difficult life, and he was basically an unhappy person, like a tremendous Talmid Chacham, but an unhappy person, a misanthrope. Now understand that he writes, by the way, he wrote an autobiography called Megillah Sefer. He writes in one place in this autobiography that for one stage of 20 years he never walked out of his house. He never left his house in 20 years. Which dovetails the next thing I want to say. In the year 1750, just to give an idea, in the 1750s, I mean, Altona, like all European communities at that time, there was one shul, and there was one rav, and there was one, everything was under one, I don't know, call it a board, a council, the Shev Zion Tuvei Ha'ir. You had one, in terms of the religious Jewish setup, there was one set of leaders, and their rules were binding upon everyone. There were rules about how much you could spend for a wedding, and how much you could spend for a funeral, and so on and so forth, and everybody lived by these rules. If you didn't, you got fined. It was a very organized and structured killer. There were no private minyanim in the basement, and then somebody's somewhere else. Okay, that didn't exist. Okay, with the exception of the following. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, because he was, again, a person with difficulty dealing with other people, didn't want to be with other people, and he was respected as a Talmid Chacham. He received permission to have a private minyan in his house. Exactly a minyan, 10 people, kadavin, that way he wouldn't have to leave his house to come to the shul. It's actually, the Yonatan Eberschitz and the Yaakov Emden actually lived around the corner from each other, and saw each other once in their lifetime. As Dr. Lyman said, and they both regret it. But the Rabbi Yaakov Emden was at home, a bit of a recluse, and he had a private minyan in his house, again of 10 people. Well, when the Knesset Yechezkel, who had been the previous Rav of Altona, died, Rabbi Yonason Eberschitz in 1750 was elected chief rabbi of Altona. So he moved from Metz to Altona that year at the age of 60. Again, Rabbi Yonason Eberschitz and Yaakov Emden were two great Talmidei Chachamim, two of the great in a generation, as I demonstrated before, of great Talmidei Chachamim. These were two of the greats. Rabbi Yonason Eberschitz, most people who are qualified to make these comments say Rabbi Eberschitz was on another level, completely on a higher level, but for the rest of us, I mean, these were two great Talmidei Chachamim. Rabbi Yonason Eberschitz was considered the mind, the Gadol Hador, and say the Rosh Yeshiva. What was the controversy that shook 18th century Jewry? On Thursday, February 4th, 1751, Yaakov Emden announced to his minion by Kriyas HaTorah in his house. He had that private minion of 10 people that had special permission to daven with him. And again, the community allowed it out of respect to him, the Talmid Chacham, and they recognized his personality, whatever else they let. So he made an announcement that he read a Kameya that was written by Yonason Eberschitz. A Kameya is an amulet. In those days, there were people, still some people around today, although it's probably less popular than it once was, who would use various Kabbalistic formulae to, they would write with the Shem Hashem, and they would give it to somebody, maybe a woman in childbirth. Even today, sometimes, you can get those little cards that have the Chantan and the Psukim and different things, Shmirli Oledus. I'm sure we've all seen it, no? You can get those things, have a few at home. But, they're available. And find Judaic stores. And anyway, but in those days, they were written by, you went to a Talmid Chacham, you went to somebody who was known, by the way, as a Baal Shem. When we say the Baal Shem, we're usually referring to the Baal Shem Tov. We saw Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic movement. But a Baal Shem meant somebody who knew how to use the Shem Hashem, Baal Shem, the name of God. He knew how to use it for, you know, with various tefillahs and incantations and so on, and this could heal you, and whatever else. I don't call faith healing, exactly that kind of thing. And Rabbi Yonasan Eberschitz, in addition to being acknowledged as a great Talmud Chacham and as the Rosh Hashiva of his door, was acknowledged as an expert in this area as well. When people needed things, they went to him, or certain people at least went to him, and he would write this kamei. You'd wear it, you'd put it down somewhere, whatever you did with it, and this would bring you whatever refuahs and yeshuas that you needed. And Yonasan was known as a Baal Shem. And people, as I say, he would heal people, especially sick people, in childbirth, etc., based on his Kabbalistic prayers and you know, permutation of God names and so on. He was an acknowledged expert. Well, on that Thursday morning, February 4th, 1751, Yaakov Emden said he just received a copy of a Kameya that was written by Yonasan Eberschitz, and he said such a Kameya could only be written by somebody who was a secret follower of Shabtai Tzvi. In fact, what he announced was that the chief rabbi of Altana is a Sabbatian. That was what Yaakov Emden said. And he demonstrated how he felt that there's no way, based on, again, the letters and this and that, the chief rabbi, Rabbi Yonasan Eberschitz, is a Sabbatian. The truth is, he had already been accused of such, had Rabbi Yonasan Eberschitz, earlier when he was living in Prague. Remember I told you before, he was the Darshan of Prague, and he was the Av Beis Din of Prague. He never became chief rabbi of Prague. Even though, back in 1724, he had gotten up on Yom Kippur in his shul and publicly denounced Shabtai Tzvi and publicly denounced the Sabbateans, but we know this today, sometimes there's an accusation, and at least to some extent it sticks, even if it turns out not to be true and so on, it hurts the reputation. Well, anyway, this is now many years later, this is more than 25 years later, but again, Yaakov Emden is announcing that the chief rabbi of Altana and the great Rosh Yeshiva is a Sabbatian. And as I said before, Yaakov Emden had a printing press in his house. He did not suffice to just share this information with the 10 people who dabbled in this private minion. And again, he felt this is something that has to be publicized and dealt with immediately. And so he printed up stuff and it was passed around, initially around, you know, pamphlets and so on, attacking. And you can just imagine. That's why this is the scandal that shook 18th century Jewry. Initially in Altona, Hamburg, Wandsbek, that town, and what went on immediately, of course, the Yonasan Eberschitz responded that it's not true, and his followers and people believed, and some people didn't believe, and it was a back and forth, and it was a disaster for the Jewish community. Fist fights broke out in shul, fist fights in the street. A German newspaper recorded that one day the Hamburg Stock Exchange had to close because the Jewish businessmen were fighting on the floor and they couldn't get any business done. This is what went on. Again, nasty comments back and forth. And of course it spread. This kind of news spreads even without the internet and everything else. But it happened faster today. But even in that world, in the 1750s, it spread to other communities and around. Rabbanim took sides on both sides. There are people who felt that Yaakov Emden is correct. Rabbi Yonasan Eberschitz is a closet Sabbatian, and he has to be exposed, he has to resign his post. His followers said that, you know, Yaakov Emden is crazy, and he's jealous because he became the chief rabbi, and he didn't, and whatever else, all this kind of stuff, back and forth, fights, families split over this. Okay, there are people, we have records of families who didn't, brothers and sisters, whatever, brothers, who didn't speak to each other anymore over this issue. It divided, and it rocked the entire Jewish world. At that time, the Rabbanim, as I say, took sides on one side or the other. Well, Yaakov Emden placed Rabbi Yonasan Eberschitz in Cheren. Yonasan Eberschitz placed Rabbi Yaakov Emden in Cheren. Those who sided with Yaakov Emden placed Rabbi Yonasan Eberschitz to support it in Cheren, and Yonasan Eberschitz to support it placed Rabbi Yaakov Emden in Cheren. So basically, if you were a Rav in the 1700s, in addition to having smicha, you were in Cheren. Because you were on one side or the other, one side or the other put you in cherem. Now what that did, naturally, was, you know, the cherem's a joke. And, you know, meanwhile, Jewish life went on, and rabbinic authority had to go on, and community structure had to go on, but this did a tremendous thing to weaken that, because every, you know, well, I don't have to listen to this, Rav, he's in cherem anyways. Right? So if you had a din Torah and the Rav ruled against you, so well, I don't listen to him. He's recommended to put him in chayim. We're going to listen to him. Put him in chayim. You know what I mean? So this weakened the entire structure of the Jewish world. Okay, each one published things, dismissed it. Rav Yosef Eibishitz published an impressive list of rabbanim who supported him, and Rav Emden responded to the list. Yeah, well, that one's his cousin, and this one's his talmid, and that one's his neighbor. And this, had all kinds of teirus. And Yosef Eibishitz, let's remember, had thousands of talmidim, and therefore Rav Emden said, "Oh, very good. You can get his talmidim to swear for him." But I'm telling you now, let's understand something. Yeah. Hamburg, Altona is like next to Hamburg.
Okay, so this is the city of Hamburg?
Yeah, well, yeah, Altona, there were three cities together. How many Jewish people, families? Probably about 250 Jewish families at that time. Okay, there. Altona, there were three cities next to Altona, Hamburg, Wandsbeck, where we're next to each other. Hamburg is, I guess, the most famous that we've heard. Yeah, families, at that time, I don't know, maybe that time, five or six people per family. So that's the number. But again, that's where it started, but it spread, and again, it spread throughout Europe with prominent Rabbanim, again, people you've all heard of, including many of the names I mentioned earlier, taking sides on this issue, being put in cherem by the other side. Understand, by the way, that if you're declaring that the chief rabbi is sabbaking, and as I said before, there was one rabbi in the town. So that means the shechita in that town is no good. That means the mikveh in that town is no good, because that's all under the supervision of the chief rabbi. So if you're again, it's not just a personal attack. It has tremendous ramifications. We have to have other shochtim and build a different mikveh. I mean, this was something that simply ripped apart the Jewish community there, and as I say, had tremendous ripple effects elsewhere. Now, understand Yaakov Emden was undoubtedly a kanoi. But he felt he was doing what needed to be done to eliminate the Sabbatian movement from European Jewry. And by the way, Rav Yosef Eibishitz was not the only person he attacked. And to a great extent, regardless of what you may think of him at the end of all of this, because, the mystery remains open today, although today people aren't having fistfights about it, it's more a matter of scholars debating it today. But, the issue is not really closed today. At that time, though, it impacted daily life. Now, as I say, it's in the realm of scholarship to figure out was Rabbi Yaakov Emden right or wrong. But one thing for sure, Rabbi Yaakov Emden's campaign did, in effect, end the Sabbatian movement in most places in Europe. I say you had a few here and there subsequent to that, but in terms of Jews who were, who were practicing it, he did eradicate it. People were afraid of him and so on. He is entitled to the credit of having more or less ended the Shabtai Tzvi movement. Later on, he would turn his attention to a different movement, the Chassidish movement. That's a different talk. But he kind of, it's interesting, today the Chassidim like his writing. They follow him. Things have changed. But the Sabbatian movement was really ended, as a force, due to the efforts of Yaakov Emden. People paid, he paid a heavy price, and the Eibishitz paid a heavy price, but that's what, what was going on. The up-and-coming great scholar, one of the up-and-coming great scholars of that time I mentioned before, is the Notabi Huda of Prague. The Mecheska Landau of Prague. Again, a great, a gone utzim, the Gedolei Achronim. Again, the words, I don't do justice. Again, people involved in learning study his works. The Tzlach, if you've heard of the Tzlach, is a commentary on the Shas. And the Dogum Revov is a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. And it's true with the Notabi Huda. Again, one of the greats, the Rav in Prague. He tried to make peace. Okay, but Rav Yaakov Emden wouldn't hear of it. And therefore eventually accused of Rabbi Huda of being a Sabbatian also. Right? It was just one thing like the other. Peir Shua, however, supported Yaakov Emden. Peir Shua was one of the greats also. He supported Yaakov Emden. He's right. He thought if that Kameh is true and other Kameh like that is true, he is a Sabbatian. Which again, let's remember, as I said before, many of the Sabbatians were not outwardly distinguishable from others. And the fact is, we'll mention later, one of Yonis Eibishitz's sons became a Sabbatian and announced it was a Sabbatian. Okay, and so were some of his Talmidim. Of course, you have thousands of Talmidim, so some of the Talmidim don't do what you want to do. The Rav suffered the same fate, right? But when you have an open door policy, the Minister and Abishas did. But in any event, Rabbi Huda tried to make a pshara, and he basically said, listen, we'll drop this whole thing. Rabbi Yonason should not be involved anymore in Kameis. We're not going to publish his works on Kabbalistic stuff, of which he had works. And we'll follow his Torah, his great Torah, right? The commentary on the Choshen Mishpat called the Tumim, the Kreisu Plesi, his other works on Torah and on Haftorahs and so on and so forth. We'll stay away from, we'll kind of separate the man from the Kabbalist, if you will. Yonason Eibishitz was willing to go along with that because the Chil Hashem, as you can imagine, was tremendous. Again, we recommend and would not go along with it. And Rabbi Yaakov Emden, you know, torpedoed any efforts at Pshara, to the extent that, as I said before, the controversy still rages. It is really unclear. There is, again, Dr. Lyman and somebody else recently published an article, when we say recently, I said in the last five or six years, where they found additional kameyas for this. The evidence that Rabbi Yaakov Emden had was solid evidence. And there was hundreds of pieces of evidence. Some was not solid, but some of it was. Again, I'm not saying, it doesn't mean that the understanding actually was a Sabbatian. But one can understand where the Yaakov Emden and those people who opposed the Gunnarsson came from. It was not a simple thing. Just to give you one example, and this is a, you know, a story that Dr. Lyman tells based on his own experience. Gunnarsson Abishit had a wife whose name was Elkala. And when his wife died of breast cancer in 1755, he buried her, obviously, and subsequently prepared a Natseva tombstone for her burial site in the cemetery there in Altona, Hamburg. Rabbi Yaakov Emden writes in one of his books, he says, remember, he never left his house, but he said someone told him about the matseva on the tombstone of Elkala Abishitz, and he said, if you want any further proof that he's a Sabbatian, then go take a look at the tombstone on the grave of Elkala Abishitz. And, you know, many tombstones, even today, and I just don't even hear sometimes, you know, they take the name and make an acrostic, right? They go down, it says, in this case, that Elkalus or whatever he wrote about her. But he said, if you look, you see on the other side, or the one part, you see the letters, it spells out, Shin Beis Tov Yud Sam Shabtai Tzadi. Shin Beis Tov Yud Tzadi, Shabtai Tzadi. And Rabbi Yaakov Emden said, in his own wife's tombstone, he put a reference to Shabtai Tzvi. Her Matseva spells out Shabtai Tzvi in acrostic form. On the right side it says Elkala, and elsewhere you can spell out the Shabtai Tzadi. And he had it written out. Again, he had a printing press. He published this and circulated all over the world for everybody to see. By the way, this was republished by Rabbi Yaakov Emden in 1769, which was after Rabbi Yonason himself had died. It raged on even after Rabbi Yonason's death. So, is that a proof? Seems like it's interesting. All you got to do is go to the cemetery and see it for yourself. So, Dr. Shneur Lyman reports the following. He went to the cemetery, traveled to Europe, to go see this for himself. And he went to the old cemetery there, and he found the tombstone, you know, on the grave of Elkala Abishitz. And he said it was completely covered over with moss. So it's like Indiana Jones, you know. He starts scraping off them, and he's expecting like a big spear to pop out of the ground or something. But anyway, he starts scraping off the moss, and sure enough, you see Elkala, you know, the acrostic, and you also see the letters Shin Beis, Tav Yud, and Sadi larger, but there were other letters also larger. They didn't have the kind of engraving, precise engraving tools that we have today. So yes, there are raised letters, and if you look at it in a certain way, okay, those letters are somewhat raised together with various other letters. So Dr. Lyman believes that in this particular case, that is, that's not, and it's not, and even the Shabtai doesn't even work in acrostic, you have to put two letters next to each other. So Dr. Lyman's conclusion that this piece of evidence, is not at all conclusive that there's anything, Sabbatian about Rabbi Yonason Abishitz, but it's interesting that she died on Asara B'Tavis. She died on Asara B'Tavis. And it says on the tombstone, you know, Elkala Abishit, Elkala Bas, whoever, on Asara B'Tavis, Yom, it says, Nepach, Asara B'Tavis, Nepach L'Dvai Ulekino. A day that's been transformed to a day of sadness and wailing. So people say, wait a second, what do you mean transformed? Asara B'Tavis is a fast day. It's already a day of sadness on our calendar. Oh, because I told you before that the Sabbatians did not observe the fast day. They observed the fast as a holiday. So he says, this was a holiday for us, and now because of this terrible thing, my wife died, Nepach, the day was, again, it's inconclusive evidence, because Asar B'Tavis, well, it is a fast day, we don't usually associate it with days of, a day of Davai Mekina, it's not, so he says, Nepach got even worse, so to speak. So, you know, discuss that. Also, very often in rabbinic literature we find a year, if we can find some gematria for that year, so that, let's say now it's Tufshin Ayin Aleph, right, 5771. So I don't know offhand, I didn't have time to think of one, but there may be a couple of words you put together also, it adds up to 5771. If you print the safer in this year, it'll say, in the cover page, it'll say, Nidfas Shnas you know, simcha, whatever, something positive. You know, that's the year it was printed. So on her matzeva, it was the year Tov Kuf Tesvav, 515. He writes Shnas Shiro, okay, which is Tov Kuf Tesvav. However, Shira was also something that was used by Sabbateans as an acronym for Shabtai Yorum Hodo. They said, why did he pick the nickname Shira to put on the tombstones? He had all these, again, these are small pieces of evidence, but it's a fascinating point nonetheless. Now, just to give you an idea, you know, at one point how it affected the common folks. I mean, Yaakov Emden's house was broken into and a lot of his papers taken away by people. He himself writes that anybody who was against him, he cursed. I have here a little pamphlet on this, a topic related to this. In a book called Vayakum Edus Yaakov, one of his many, published in Altman in 1756, Yaakov Emden reports that there was a young couple in Altman whose home had become a popular meeting place for the Abishus forces. The young couple had a wine cellar in their home, which also helped to attract the crowd. Shabbos afternoons, the group, the Kiddush Club, right? Shabbos afternoons, the group used to convene and imbibe. On one occasion, two of Yaakov Emden's followers joined the crowd. A drinking bout ensued, and several of Yonason's enthusiasts made a l'chaim in honor of the chief rabbi of Yonason. The two Emden enthusiasts immediately rose and made a l'chaim in honor of Yaakov Emden. Apparently, their l'chaim concluded with a blessing to the effect that the young couple's children should grow up to be like Yaakov Emden. The wife, whose toddler was in an adjacent room and was pregnant at the time, immediately had the Emden enthusiast thrown out of her house while shouting at them, "Sooner than my son be like him, Yaakov Emden, may he die. And if such will be its fate, may my fetus be aborted." Yaakov Emden concludes the account by noting that even before the Emden enthusiasts were up on their feet, the toddler was struck down and died, the funeral taking place the next morning on Sunday. Shortly afterwards, the woman suffered a miscarriage, paying dearly for her verbal attack on Yaakov Emden. Of course, Yaakov Emden, when he printed his printed names, the husband's name, and you know, this was all published during the lifetime of the people, so it's not fabricated. You get an idea from this, that's why I call it, you know, the controversy that shook 18th century Jewry. Well, as I said before, the result is Yaakov Emden got rid of the Sabbatean movement, but again, it had become personal, as we mentioned. And when these personal attacks go, it goes further. The Yonason Abishus was accused of fathering a child with his daughter. He was accused of sleeping with the wives of his Talmidim. I mean, that's what happens when these things come out. So then it just goes on ad absurdum, all kinds of accusations in both directions. The Goyim got involved, okay, to add to the Chil Hashem. Newspapers, the Goyish newspapers printed making fun of the Jews, saying, "Isn't it interesting? The Jews are fighting each other over whether Messiah came or not." Right? They're good Christians, you know, they mocked the Jewish community. They fight with each other to argue about whether the Messiah has arrived or not. Again, you get the picture of the Chil Hashem. At one point, the Goyish government ordered Yaakov Emden to actually leave town, which he did for a short while. But the King of Denmark later fined the communal leaders for making him leave. And then again, everybody who was anybody was involved in this. Controversy. In the 1760s, there were students in Yonason Abishut, including his own son, as I mentioned, who were found to be Sabbateans, eventually allied with the Frankists. I said Frank was the guy who was allegedly a reincarnation of Sabbatai Tzvi, and his yeshiva was eventually closed. Now, the Noda Behuda, and this will wrap up, the Noda Behuda, although he quote-unquote lost in his attempt to solve the problem at that time, did win in a certain sense. Because today, Yonason Abishutz is Torah study. And people, other than, you know, it's an interesting subject, but other than this intrigue, his Kabbalistic works are not generally published. Somebody, I think my son told me that you know, I'm taking this course, he said that recently someone wanted to print one of Yonason's Kabbalistic works, and the Rabbanim Yishalayim told him he can't print it. Yonason Abishutz is known for his great Talmud Torah, for he separated the Talmud Chochem and Mekubal. But again, a heavy price, Jews fought. The guy made fun of them, and this was not lost on not only the average balabas, but on the children of the next generation also, because respect for Rabbanim, respect for Jewish leaders, and respect indeed for Jewish behavior hit a low. Just like to conclude by reading a fascinating piece in the Haggadah of Rabbi Marcus Lehman, a copy, and many of you may have this at home. It's not a rare book in any way. The Lehman Haggadah. Marcus Lehman, Rabbi Dr. Marcus Lehman, was a German Rav, lived from 1831 to 1890, so he's in the next century. He was a Rav in Mainz, and he also published an Orthodox Jewish newspaper, and he wrote many historical fiction works. At a time when books were becoming popular, especially on young people, he felt it was worthwhile to have books, novels, that Jewish kids could read, you know, adventure novels, and kind of based on history and so on. So a number of works by Marcus or Meir Lehman. He actually became Rav Shul in Mainz. The main shul in Mainz introduced an organ into the shul in response to the reform, and so another group, the more Orthodox members broke off from the shul and made a new shul. Marcus Lehman was the rabbi in the new shul. Anyway, so we have a number of books, and we have this Haggadah, the Lehman Haggadah. So, in my edition here on page 16, he writes the following. This is a drush, on the fact that we say regarding the Pesach Seder HaLaila Hazeh, Kulo Matzah. Okay? And he has a play on words, Matzah, we know it's Matzah. But, you know, without vowels, it can be read Mitzah, Nem, with a chirik on Mitzah, which means quarrel. Like those of million parsha Shmos, Shnei, Anashim, Yivim, Mitzim, fighting with each other. Right? People fighting. V'hatzosom al Hashem. So, Halayla Hazeh, he says, refers to Golos. This Golos is Kulo Mitzah. It's all strife. And listen to what Marcus Lehman writes in his Haggadah. There's been no lack of pious and holy men and women in the many centuries of the present Golos. But salvation could not appear because of the innumerable conflicts dividing people. Sects and parties have continuously disturbed the peace of the exile. Tzedukim, Itusim, Minin, Karaites, Sabbatians, etc., have brought distress and confusion to the community of Jacob scattered throughout the world. But there were other squabbles that did not involve great matters of principle. They often arose over trifling affairs, and these conflicts turned into hate and enmity, which sometimes affected a large proportion of Jewry, but more frequently caused utter confusion within individual communities. Alas, the situation is no better today. He's writing in the 1800s. It is not sufficient that we have enemies about us. We also cause enmities amongst ourselves and often make our lives bitter for really trivial reasons. About 2 centuries ago, the study of the Talmud blossomed amongst German Jewry as perhaps never before. The communities of Germany, both large and small, were distinguished for their deep and upright piety. Yeshivas were to be found in every city in which Jews dwelled: Prague, Fürth, Frankfurt am Main, Mainz, Worms, Mannheim, Karlsruhe, Berlin, Breslau, Frankfurt, Oder, Halberstadt, and in numerous smaller places to which youths eager for learning streamed from all parts of Germany. Then there arose an unholy dispute which was directed particularly against the great and innocent Abishitz. The damage caused by this dispute and the extent to which it contributed towards dissuading young people from studying Torah and demoralizing the ranks of the God-fearing cannot be adequately described. We still had an opportunity of hearing the accounts of contemporaries who lived through that dispute. And he's living in 1800s, heard accounts from people who were there. We do not speak of the dissensions caused by the so-called reform movement, but it is most inexcusable that there is continuous conflict and dispute amongst the Orthodox and faithful Israelites. Halayla azeh kulo mitzah, for it lengthens the night of the Golos. Very powerful words from somebody who lived in the next generation, basically, the next century, saying that this dispute dissuaded people from learning Torah, it dissuaded the young, and you can see what a tremendous chil Hashem this caused. P.S. There is a Hebrew version of the Haggadah Shel Pesach, Mefureshes Bidei HaRav Meir Lehman, a Hebrew channel. I don't own this. I went to the YU library last week. The librarian was puzzled as to why he'd be taking out Haggadah this time of year. He said he didn't get too many requests for Haggadah this week. But anyway, this is the Marcus Lehman Haggadah translated into Hebrew. Okay, called Meir Nesiv. His name is Meir. His commentary is called Meir Nesiv. Translated from German into Hebrew. This was put out in B'nai Brak in 1967. That piece that I just read you does not appear in this Haggadah. It was censored out. And you skip, I mean, you can come up and take a look after if you want, you won't see anything. You'll just see the previous paragraph. I wanted to see this myself because this is what I heard. And it goes directly from his criticism of the Tzedukim, Baitusim, and everybody else, Sabbatians, right on to the next subject. The whole harangue relating to the end of the Abishitz controversy and then debilitated that effect, and that was excised out. Why was it excised out? I don't know. You know, it's censorship, a little bit intellectual, more than a little bit intellectually dishonest, but that's what happened. To end the talk, legend has it that on his deathbed, as his soul was departing, Rabbi Yaakov Emden was heard greeting his father, Rabbi Tzvi Ashkenazi, author of the Shalos Hatshuvos Chacham Tzvi, who died in 1718. The imagery here is that of the departing soul greeting the souls on high that he's just meeting now. This was immediately followed by Rabbi Yaakov Emden's last words, immortal, "Greetings, Rabbi Yonatan." Upon his death, the burial society convened to settle on an appropriate gravesite for Rabbi Yaakov Emden's burial. In the rabbinical section of the cemetery on the Königstrasse in Altona, there was only one empty plot, just five graves away from that of Rabbi Yonatan Eibeshitz. The members of the burial society were not prepared to bury these two lifelong enemies in such proximity to each other. Perchance, if Yecheskel Landau of Prague, the Node of Yehuda, happened to be visiting Altona at the time and was asked to decide the issue. He ruled that since Rabbi Yaakov Emden and Rabbi Eibeshitz had finally made peace with each other, as evidenced by Rabbi Yaakov Emden's greeting of Yonasan in his dying breath, it was appropriate that they be buried near each other. Anyone who visits the Altona Cemetery today will be able to attest to the fact that at least part of the legend is true. Rabbi Yaakov Emden and Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz rest in peace some five graves apart from each other. Again, the issue that rocked 18th century Jewry, sadly excised, for whatever reason, out of the Hebrew translation of the Haggadah of Marcus Lehman, that I heard from Yitzhak Bernstein, who was a rabbi in England, I listened to some of his tapes, and he made reference to this in a totally different context. He said, ladies and gentlemen, he said, you can change the Marcus Lehman Haggadah. You can't change history. And what happened, happened. And it's a dark mark on our people, and as Marcus Lehman said, it's bad enough that we have tzaras from our sworn enemies. It's bad enough that we have tzaras from people who are not Anshei Shalmeinu in terms of observance and mitzvahs. But in Marcus Lehman's words, it's inexcusable that there's such strife and such difficulty among the Orthodox as well. And the Golus continues for that reason. May it end speedily and in our days. Thank you for listening.